Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Happy Saturday, folks. It's Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Wow. You know, every time you think you have a tumultuous week, the next week comes along and it's 10x tumultuous. Chaos. Kind of love it, actually. That's what we hired Mr. Trump to do. Remember, we didn't elect Donald Trump. We hired Donald Trump. And his wrecking ball. And he's swinging it well. So we have the State of the Union, which we're going to talk about tonight, or actually this morning, once again, dark out, 2:30 in the morning. It is, look, I have a bunch of stuff to cover with you on this show. Some of it's going to be brief, but it's things which nobody else is talking about, some international stuff, which is really important. The press, I don't care whether it's left or right or in between, the press is in a feeding frenzy over this memo from the House Intelligence Committee, and the revelations, and Rosenstein, and Comey, and, you know, Strzok, and the whole nine yards. We're going to talk a little bit about that. I'm not going to repeat what I'm sure you have heard. I mean, if you have turned on a radio or turned on a TV, I'm not going to repeat that stuff, other than as background to give you foundation for information I'm going to give you that you have not heard about this mess. We're going to talk about the memo itself, which is going to be toward one of the last segments. And I'm going to explain to you exactly on a really big picture, a stratospheric level, what the Democratic reaction, and I'm going to go down the list for you, at the SOTU, the State of the Union speech, what that reaction, coupled with five or six other facts, I mean, I can pick out 1,000, but I'm going to pick out ones which are really recent and kind of blatant in your face. Because what's going on here, folks, is not politics. It is a war of values. I have often said on this show, particularly over the last several years, that we are engaged in a battle for the Republic. We are in a war for the heart and soul of America, her future, and therefore your future, and the future of your children and your children's children. And I kind of set this up in my last show last week. If you didn't listen to it, you should. We're going to talk very briefly about some economic stats, but my show 3 weeks ago, The Canaries in the Economic Coal Mine, is part of the title. If you type that in the search bar, Canaries in the Economic Coal Mine, Economic Mine, that'll come up. You should listen to it. I can't tell you how many emails I got on that, how many comments I got on that. Because, look, many things are going really great. But the underlying fundamentals, not only of America, but of the Western world with its debt and its quantitative easing, its great experiment in printing money to buy its own bonds. And I'm not just talking about America. I'm talking about all the Western countries, basically the world's economy. The underlying fundamentals, which Donald Trump has nothing to do with. I mean, this is the result of lousy policies going back basically to Lyndon Johnson and put on steroids on purpose by Barack Obama. Those fundamentals have not gone away. And while you should enjoy all the good stuff that's happening, you should also have your safety net either laid out or getting laid out. And if you never need it, terrific. And if you do need it, it could mean the difference between smiles and frowns, tears and laughter, and security and complete insecurity. And that's going to be part of my show next week. So this is kind of an advanced teaser for you. And it's going to be, let me tell you, it'll be stuff that you have not heard before, I guarantee you. And we're going to have some of that here in the very last segment of this show, or maybe just before I do the last segment, which might be this this House Intelligence Committee memo. Basically what it contains, but more importantly, because, listen, you can get what it contains from anybody, and you'll be able to read it for yourself, what it means. You know, that's what I bring to you. I bring to you things that you haven't heard before. I tie them together, and I tell you what I think it means. And in many cases, unfortunately, I have been right on. Because, you know, if you use your head, you understand what's going on in various sectors of the economy, in various places in the world. If you have a feel for what drives and motivates all these many players with their agendas, you can kind of see how today's events are going to shape the events and circumstances a year from now, 6 months from now, 2 years from now. An advance warning of either good things or bad things is really, really, really valuable. All right, so I'm going to start off this morning with a story. Huh, imagine that. It's a story for you. And this story is kind of cool. This is kind of like a Paul Harvey story, you know? Here's the rest of the story. And it's true. It's another true one. So let's go back to 1876. It is 1876 in Edinburgh University in merry old England. And there was a medical professor at this university, and he was giving a lecture to a group of students. And he was pounding home how important observation is. You know, this I really like this story this morning because it ties into what I just told you. If you observe, if you see the clues, if you connect the dots, you have a fairly good grasp of what's going to be happening in the future. And, you know, that puts you ahead of 99.99% of the humans on the planet, which gives you a huge advantage. So anyway, this professor, who is quite well known and revered for being one smart dude, is talking to his class. And he was pounding home the theme of, quote, the vast importance of little distinctions, of the endless significance of trifles, unquote. So, you know, the students were sitting there, as students do now, and as students did then, as students did 200 years before, going, oh man, this is so boring. When are we going to get out of this class? And the professor wanted to do he wanted to show them an example. So he calls for a patient. He had several patients waiting out in the hall. He calls for the patient so that he can demonstrate to the students how to examine a patient, how to read these little distinctions, these endless significance of trifles, to arrive at a big conclusion and a correct conclusion. And the first patient walks in. The professor walked around him slowly twice. And then the professor said something like, quote, Army, recently discharged, probably Scots Highland Regiment. You were likely a non-commissioned officer, probably in the West Indies, probably Barbados. Well, the patient confirmed every single supposition of the professor made in those few seconds and two walk-arounds of the patient with a, aye, sir. Aye, sir. And that caught the class's attention. They were intrigued. And the professor, whose name was Joseph Bell, explained how he had arrived at each conclusion, every guess. They were completely amazed. Let me quote, because one of the students was so impressed by all this that he wrote it down verbatim. Quote, the man appeared courteous and respectful, but did not remove his hat. Members of the army do not, so he was likely recently discharged. His gait and tone tells me he's Scottish, thus the Highland Regiment, and he had an air of authority suggesting he was a non-com. and the mild elephantitis evident on his arms tells me he was stationed in Barbados, where there have been recent outbreaks, unquote. The whole class was impressed, but there was one student, the student who wrote down the professor's words verbatim, who was completely in awe. And for the next few years, as he had Bell for successive classes as his professor, he became more and more in awe of Bell and Bell's ability to observe things, draw correct conclusions. And he found every day with Bell fascinating. He gave there's another example. So the door of the classroom is closed one day, and a student knocks on the door. And Bell, who had been sitting at his desk the rest of the class, including this student who was so in awe of Bell, the rest of the class was doing a test or doing something. And Bell, without looking up, said, "What are you worried about?" And through the door, the student said, "How did you know I was worried?" Still not looking up, Bell said, "You knocked 4 times. The timid knock once. Most men knock either 2 or 3 times. The worried knock 4 times. Pretty amazing. Anyway, the student graduated. He moved on from Professor Bell, hung out his own doctor's shingle. But he didn't do well. Just wasn't a good businessman. Great doctor, but not a good businessman. He was in the wrong location, didn't have enough patients. And to support himself, he began to write books, which kind of intrigued me, of course. And he wanted to write a book that kind of had a unique character. So he chose a detective, an incredibly observant detective. Like Dr. Bell, his mentor, the professor he was always in awe of. And for this character, this detective, this observant detective, he gave him a sidekick, which happened to be a curious but not as observant doctor, kind of like himself. So now, as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story. The author Conan Doyle, that's Arthur Conan Doyle, portrayed himself as Dr. Watson, always standing in the shadow of his hero, who was, in fact, modeled after the great Dr. Bell, but whom he named Sherlock Holmes. I love that story. Love that story. And I hope you did, too. Now, let's get into the show. And by the way, to tie this into this show, although I think you've probably made that quantum leap of connection, it is my job to be your Dr. Bell when it comes to international, national, domestic, political, financial, and all sorts of other things going on. And boy, there's a lot going on. And it's your job to take my clues that I give you, that nobody else does, and my guesses, because they are. I mean, when you make a prognostication until it occurs, you don't know if you're right or wrong. To run them through the very able brain that you have, to come up with your own conclusions, and to act, react, protect, or advance accordingly. That is why I do this show. Because we are all Americans. And the more we know, and the more accurate our guesses as to future events, the better for our country, the better for our family, and the better for our children and our children's children. And obviously, the better for our freedoms. So, the very first thing I'm going to tell you about, I think 2 or 3 weeks ago, I've brought up several times the disaster going on in England with the national health system. You know, single payer. Hey, Bernie, have you been reading these articles, Bernie, or Brock, or any of the Dems who so want to control your health care, stem to stern, single payer? This is an unmitigated disaster. We know about the problems in Canada. you know, waiting 6 to 18 months for a procedure that down here you could get in for a week. We know about all that. I mean, there is no country on the planet with socialized medicine which does not have some type of structural problem in healthcare. We have our own, right, which is cost. Our structural problem is cost. But that has to do with crony capitalism, Obamacare, horrendous deals that Obama made to get Obamacare through at the expense of your wallet, which he well knew, but he doesn't care. We're going to be talking about the Democrats, the progressives, and how they don't care about a lot of things here in just a little bit in this show. And on full display now. Thank you, Mr. Trump, for bringing them out of the closet. So in that show, I talked about, and I believe, once again, if you put in National Health Service or England Healthcare, that show will come up from several weeks ago. You can listen to that segment. So in the week or two before Christmas and New Year's, there were 16,000 plus, I have the exact number in the show, people who were transported by ambulances to hospitals. And they waited in the ambulances for 30 minutes or more because there was no room in the emergency rooms to bring them into it. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine having a heart attack, being in a ambulance? Or, you know, having an artery wound because you were in a car wreck or whatever, and the ambulance picks you up, and then you wait outside the emergency room doors for 30 to 60 minutes before they get you in. Think about that. Well, listen, the disaster is continuing and spiraling downhill, as most things do when the government is involved, and it doesn't matter which government. So last week, there was a headline on the BBC's website. You can go take a look at it. Quote, patients dying in hospital corridors. 60 doctors wrote letters, like Britain's top doctors, 68 doctors, excuse me, wrote a letter detailing inhuman conditions, which are prevalent and which have become inherent and structural in Britain's National Health Services hospitals. 300, listen to this number, 300,000 patients were made to wait in emergency rooms. This is after 16,000 of them had waited to even get in the emergency room from the ambulance. 300,000 patients were made to wait in emergency rooms for more than 4 hours without being seen. Think about that. You have something which necessitates an ambulance picking you up. You don't get into the emergency room from the ambulance at the front door of the emergency room for 30 to 60 minutes. And then when you do get into the emergency room, you wait 4 hours for a doctor to see you. Just think about that. Anytime anybody talks to you about single-payer health care and government-run healthcare, you can throw these stats at them. And this is the facts, Jack. It's routine, this letter said, for patients to be left on gurneys in hospital corridors for up to 12 hours before getting into a hospital bed. Whew, man, 120 patients per day in each of the National Health Service hospitals are being attended to in the corridors because there are no rooms for them and no beds for them. One patient, which is in this article, reports, you women will love this, right? If there's any libs listening to me, you gals who think that single-payer healthcare, Bernie Sanders, blah, 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 is like the epitome of ecstasy and happiness in healthcare, you can listen to this little story. So one gal in the article went to the emergency room. Took her forever to get in. She had a gynecological problem, severe pain, bleeding, all sorts of stuff. They finally got her out of the emergency room and into the corridor, but didn't have a room for her. And she had a full gynecological examination and whatever else they had to do right in the corridor in front of like 100 people. You guys like that, huh? Hashtag me too. All right. These kind of horror stories are becoming more and more prevalent in Britain's National Health Services. And let me tell you that it happens in other state-run health across the planet. Even the Scandinavian countries, which one could argue have the most efficient single-payer systems, are beset by huge problems. They are light years ahead of Britain, but they have problems just like Canada does. So I want you to think about, and by the way, do you know what Britain's response to this has been? Well, number one, they try and shove it under the carpet. Gee, what else is new? That's what politicians do. Number two, of course, the Labour Party, that's kind of the Socialist Liberal Party, has blamed the Conservative Party for not spending enough money. Now, I believe I posted this article under Obamacare, or had the producers post it under Obamacare in this week's show. You should look at the graph on that. In 1955-56, when they started this abomination of a healthcare system over in Britain, they were spending roughly £12 billion. A pound sterling, and it's fluctuated widely in values, okay? And it had a crash that Soros initiated. I'm not going to go into all that. Let's just say a pound on the average is about $1.50 U.S. I think it's a little bit less today. But $12 billion would be about $18 billion U.S. dollars. That was their beginning budget in 1955-56. Do you know how much that has increased? Well, by 1998, it was up to around 60 billion pounds, or $90 billion. Now remember, England is a small country, folks. There's not 350 million people. So you could take England's population of, I believe, 50 to 60 million, multiply it by 7x to equate to the United States population, and then multiply the numbers. It's a numbers game. So that would mean somewhere around a 600 billion, half a trillion plus, cost the United States for a similar system that ain't working. And that was like 1998-2000. From 2000 to 2017, it increased from 60 billion to almost 150 billion pounds. 150 billion pounds. Times 150%, a pound is $1.50 to a dollar. That's, and I'm rounding numbers, 225 billion pounds. Factor in the percent, the population of the United States as a ratio to the population of Britain, and you have over $1 trillion that the United States would be spending for a similar failed single-payer system. Outrageous. Outrageous. Now, what's going to happen from all this over there? I don't know. But it's mired in politics. It's mired in cover-ups by political officials. It is crushing England's budget. In fact, England spent 30% of its domestic spending, 30% of its domestic spending on this failed system last year. Now, all the folks that were screaming about Obamacare and its costs and what would happen if we went to a single-payer system, which Obamacare was designed to lead us to, talking about costs, you just look at England, because it's all correct. A disaster. All right, that's the first little thing I want to bring to your attention before we start getting into the meat of the chaos of this last week. I loved it. International. This is a really big deal. Virtually nobody is talking about it. I mean, I doubt you've heard about it. So, you know, our friends in the Mideast, our best friends other than Israel, are the Kurds. They are also the best fighters other than the Israelis in the Mideast. And I've talked about this on previous shows. Now, the Kurds have been the most effective tool we have against ISIS. I mean, changing the rules of engagement, going after ISIS aggressively, as Donald Trump has done for U.S. troops, has really helped. But the biggest thing that has led to the virtual decimation of ISIS and the loss of 98% of their caliphate has been the Kurds, the Peshmerga, which is what they call their army. And under Obama, these people fought with, you know, 50-year-old weapons. No tanks. No nothing. And they were fighting an ISIS, which, and I'm going to be talking about this next week. Here's a little tickler for you. An ISIS which, because of this whole mess with the memo and the FBI, etc., there's new discoveries coming out about Mr. Obama, including the fact that he sent arms to ISIS. Let me underline that. He sent arms to ISIS. You know, if you go back, I'm going to digress for just a moment. If you go back to one of my shows, I don't know which one it was. I think you could probably type in Iraq or Iran in the search bar, and one of those shows will contain it. I told you that Barack Obama basically was responsible for the formation of ISIS. There was a reason he did not take action when the intelligence folks went to him in 2012 and said, hey, these guys are getting too powerful, we need to take them out, and they're out in the open on the border of Iraq, and he said no. And in the meantime, the only adversary that was having any success against them was the Kurds. And Mr. Obama, Islamist sympathizer that he is, anti-colonial kook that he is, alt-left ideologue that he is, and America hater that he is, refused to arm the Kurds. I brought up in those shows the fact that, if you remember when ISIS overran Iraq, they took over that huge military base, the Iraqi army fled in terror without firing a shot, basically, and ISIS got their hands on hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of U.S. tanks, AMRACs, armored vehicles, Humvees. I mean, basically, Barack Obama, who could have ordered an airstrike on that base in a moment to destroy that equipment, purposely allowed ISIS to become an armored army. The Peshmerga had no such armor. They had virtually nothing. Yet even though the United States, in effect, under Obama's watch, and intentionally by Obama, as I'm going to demonstrate next week, armed ISIS and did not arm our supposed allies, the Kurds. The Kurds made inroads into ISIS. They held their own. Well, the Kurds now are the largest single, we'll call it, creed in the world without their own country. There's 160 plus or minus million Kurds. They're in three kind of clumps over there in the Mideast. And they have long wanted to form their own country called Kurdistan, which Barack Obama, of course, has blocked, along with other powers, Western powers, because that would not serve their interests. And, of course, along with Iran, because it would mean the loss of their greedy little clutches on Iraq and Syria. Kurdistan would take part of Syria, it would take part of Turkey, and it would take part of Iraq. You can look on a map and you can kind of see how it works. Well, there's other things that have happened with the Kurds too, but that's not for this show. The important thing for this show is that the Turkish army under Erdogan, an Islamist replacing Turkey's democracy with an Islamist oligarchy, if you will, and by the way, aided and abetted in every step along the way by Mr. Obama. And Turkey is a NATO member, remember. Turkey has decided that it's going to launch its army against the Kurds, because they consider the Kurds terrorists, and they don't want the Kurds to have their own state, and they certainly don't want the Kurds to have their own state, which includes any Turkish lands. Trump, to his credit, has taken an entirely opposite tact of Obama. Gee, imagine that. Number one, he's destroyed ISIS. Number two, he's stopped supplying ISIS with armor and arms. Number three is unleash the American military with new rules of engagements. And number four, very importantly, he has completely armed the Kurds. They now have an armored army, up-to-date weapons, and it's getting better all the time. They've gone from fighting with their guts to fighting with weapons. And they are 10 times more effective, and they were the most effective fighting force in the Mideast, other than the United States Army. They've become 10 times more effective. There may be no army, no Mideast army that could take down the Kurds now, because America has finally stepped up for its Kurdish allies and helped them out. Well, this alarms Turkey and his Islamist ruler buddy of Barry. And he has moved Turkish forces against the Kurds and threatened to do more. And the United States, thank you, Donald, has for once stood up for its ally, the Kurds, and said, you screw with them, you're screwing with us. So there's a confrontation brewing in the Mideast that nobody's talking about, folks. And that confrontation is between the United States and Turkey. Both of them NATO members. Which could not only have huge ramifications for the Mideast, and for the price of oil, I might add, but huge ramifications for NATO, and therefore huge ramifications for the effectiveness of the bloc that NATO forms against Russia's aspersions. We're going to keep our eye on that, but just to give you a little background here, last week, of course nobody talked about it, launched an air and ground assault on there's an area of Syria called Afrin. And the whole purpose, and they stated it, was to oust the American allies, which is the People's Protection Units, or YPG. Okay, Erdogan, the Turkish president, has now threatened to extend the operation 60 miles east to a place called Manbij, which, by the way, unlike Afrin, has U.S. troops. In fact, pretty fair number of U.S. troops. Colonel Ryan Dillon was interviewed by the Washington Free Beacon. Quote, our forces there, the United States forces, are well prepared to defend themselves. We have air coverage over all our troops and allies who are prepared to defend ourselves, whether it's from ISIS or any other threat, unquote. Think about this, folks. This is the United States Army sending a warning shot across the bow of the Turkish Army. And Dillon, in that interview, reaffirmed, thank you, Donald Trump, reaffirmed American support for the Kurdish YPG fighters, who, by the way, are the backbone of the Syrian Democratic Forces. The key U.S. partner in eradicating ISIS. And as of last week, Trump has ordered the United States military to give air support to the YPG. They say against ISIS, but the message is against ISIS or Turkish forces. Dillon went on to say in this interview, quote, they, that's the Kurds, have played a role in making sure we can stay focused on defeating ISIS. That threat still exists. There's still hardcore fighting happening. And that's what we are still focused on. We don't want anything, that's a warning to Turkey, we don't want anything to distract from that, unquote. In the meantime, Turkey has urged us to withdraw our support for the Kurds or face confrontation, quote, unquote, confrontation with Turkish troops. So, relations between Turkey and America are not great, folks. There's stuff brewing in the Mideast that I will keep an eye on for you. All right. What do we got next? Oh, yes. This is just a quick little one. So, you know, I have from time to time brought up companies which are, I'll be kind, alt-left morons to whom you should not give your business. The NFL, you know, I think we all kind of get that. Starbucks, we've talked about that. Target, we've talked about that. I mean, I've talked about a number of them because some of these companies, I don't know what their CEOs or boards or whoever is doing their marketing strategy and campaigns is thinking, but you know, when 70% of the United States thinks X and this company comes out with wild alt-left Y stuff, it's not good for the company, and in my opinion, it's not good for America, although they have every right to do it. So I have another one to add to our list of companies to be avoided, because there's lots of companies out there you can buy the same stuff from, whose American heads are screwed on a little bit straighter than the companies I've mentioned in the past and the one I'm about to tell you about now. So one of the founders and the CEO of Scott E. Vess, I'm sure you've seen commercials on TV. This is the Vess where you got all the secret pockets, you can carry all your stuff, et cetera, et cetera. And actually, I thought they were kind of cool. I've never looked at them to buy one, but I mean, they would certainly work for some people. And they're called Scott E. Vess. Anyway, the founder of Scott E. Vess and the CEO actually went on January 14th. And he, this is unbelievable. He posted on his social media and tweets and said in an interview that the reason they advertise on Fox News more than any other network is that, I'm paraphrasing here, is that Fox viewers are dumb and they'll buy anything since they supported Trump. I'm not making this up, folks. I'm paraphrasing. It's even worse than that. Anyway, needless to say, his business has kind of gone into the tank, right? Into the tank. And he has removed all his social media posts. He has issued an apology. Gee, your company is going down the tubes because you came out of the closet, as Trump is good at making all the loonies do, and stated your true opinion about Trump, Trump supporters, American values, and Fox News viewers, which is that they're all worthless. Please buy my vest, you're worthless. Anyway, he had to remove his posts. He was removed as CEO of Scott E. Vess. The new CEO has posted all sorts of apologies. Quote, Mr. Jordan's post was impulsive and inappropriate for too many reasons to list and rightfully offended so many people. We strongly disagree with the views expressed by Mr. Jordan. And, well, that's another good one here. Quote, in July 2017, all of Mr. Jordan's responsibilities within our company were given to current President Marshall Rule. Oh, geez. In other words, folks, the company is now trying to say that Jordan didn't have, he said the wrong thing. He didn't have authority to say it. And whatever he said, he didn't have anything to do with the company anyway. I mean, wow. So, on your list of folks not to buy from, Starbucks, NFL, all the rest, add Scott E. Vess. All right. Now, let's talk about, you know, the memo, which is hugely important, and which is going to lead to a lot more stuff, as I'm going to explain later in the show. I mean, a lot more stuff. This is the tide turning like a tsunami on the monster the Democrats created. That monster has been reprogrammed, and now it's flesh-eating and coming after them. So we're going to talk about that. But I think what's a good foundation and what's educational and instructive to talk about before we get there is what's really going on with the so-called Democratic Party. I've long maintained the Democratic Party is no longer the Democratic Party. If you watch the response by Kennedy, the young congressman from Massachusetts, the great nephew, the son of Ted Kennedy, and the great nephew of John F. Kennedy. I think you will agree that John F. Kennedy, who, by the way, I thought was terrific in virtually all respects, that John F. Kennedy, the Democratic president of the first few years of the 1960s, would have turned over in his grave to hear his great-nephew speak. Literally, he would have turned over in his grave. That's how far left the Democratic Party has gone. They are not the Democratic Party. They are the progressive slash socialist slash Islamist party, folks. I have said it for years. It is becoming increasingly more evident with each and every day as Trump draws them further and further out of the shadows of their closet where they were hiding what they really thought, what they really want, and what they really feel about Americans, America, and American values. And just in the last week, we have seen two in-your-face, huge examples of what I have been trying to pound home for years. I mean, I can give you 1,000 examples, particularly over the 8 years of Barry. Example number one, the corruption, the existence of the deep state, the installation of a shadow government, which I talked about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, by Barry Obama and his cabal, intentional, is on full display and has been for months, if not longer, and is now being outed by the memo. The corruption inherent to this shadow government and deep state, anti-constitutional, financial, rule of law, unequal treatment and application of law, the antithesis, by the way, to the core values of America, is on full display. It is indisputable, unless you are blind, deaf, and dumb. And I think some progressives might be. In addition, the party that used to call for transparency, that used to rail against, you know, any type of government stuff, has now completely flipped, along with, by the way, their media mouthpieces. Understand that the mainstream media has now been reduced to something far from news or reporting. They are now the verbal shills for the alt-left Democratic Party. That's all they are. They will, like the Democrats themselves, resort to any means, any lie, any misrepresentation by omission, any false story, any red herring to accomplish their goals, which are the same goals as the Democratic Progressive Alt-Left slash Islamist Party. And that was on full display, both the Democratic Party and their media. Their media allies, I mean, it's stronger than allies. They're tied at the hip. They are vested in one another. That was on display for all to see over the course of this week. You have this memo put together in the House Intelligence Committee, and they followed all the steps on the proper release of that memo, unlike the thousands of leaks that have come out of the deep state, the shadow government, the media, most of them totally wrong, or made up, or contrived, out of the media and out of the Democrats as to the so-called Russian investigation. So Devin Nunes, the Republican chairman of this committee, followed all the steps. It was a party-line vote. The ranking member in that committee, Adam Schiff from California, gee, where else, is one of the slimiest, sleaziest, in some ways corrupt and in all ways unfaithful to America representative I have seen in a long time. You know, Maxine Waters is crazy. I mean, you can almost laugh at her rants. Nancy Pelosi is crazy and pathetic. You can almost laugh at her stuff. But Adam Schiff is dangerous, nasty, and in my opinion, treasonous. There was a huge campaign by Schiff, the Democrats, in concert with their media buddies, to try and block the release of this memo. This campaign was in concert with the deep state, which is getting torn apart in the FBI, and the deep state in the Department of Justice. And now we come to find out this week, There's lots of stuff coming out now. In the State Department, you know, John Kerry's and our friend Hillary's State Department. The deep state, the corruption of the deep state, the insidious installation and existence of the shadow government that Barack Obama installed quite intentionally. Number one, through his czars. Number one, through the appointment by his czars and himself of the heads of these agencies. And number three, by the appointment of the heads of these agencies, political appointees like Comey and Mueller, Clinton, Kerry, Holder, Lynch. Those people then appointed that layer of management directly below them, who were also prodigies of the democratic think of the deep state and the shadow government. I mean, folks, this was, if Hillary Clinton had been elected, this would have been a coup d'etat. We would have never found this stuff out, ever. It would have never been corrected. There would have been no accountability, and the Republic, in my opinion, would have been lost. And you know what? The alt-left folks, we're not talking about the liberals. We're not talking about the folks who think they're progressives and really don't understand the big picture. I'm talking about the true hardcore alt-left. They knew they were on the verge of winning the prize, which is the heart of America. And that is why they are so upset that the American people rose up and Donald Trump was elected, and that he's one tough nut who loves America and is dismantling what they have so painstakingly built in dark shadows over the last 40 years. It's all out in the light now, and it's getting dismantled. And that is why they're so pissed off. Nothing else. They use the red herrings of his tweets and his vulgarity and his this and his that. That's a subterfuge, folks. Way deeper is at play here. Way deeper. Let me give you an example over the course of this week. And by the way, the third example, and we're going to go over that too, is what the Democrats did not stand for at the State of the Union speech. And I know you've heard bits and pieces about that in the news, but I actually watched that speech twice. I had my senior producer watch the speech after I watched it twice, and together we came up with a list, and I'm not even sure it's complete, of everything the Democrats did not stand for during that speech, which were not left, not right, but purely American and or good for the American people, no matter your race, color, creed, religion, or political affiliation. It's just good for America stuff. Good for Americans stuff. Nothing to do with left and nothing to do with right. You're going to be astounded. I think it's probably the most complete list put together by any media outlet, period. The others have just kind of hit some high points. So those are the three glaring examples this week. So let's dive into what the Democrats, the media, and the deep state collaborated on. I mean, if you are watching the news or you are hearing even glimpses of the news, you'll see that Adam Schiff or some mouthy alt-left Democrat will say XYZ, which is a total fabrication and lie. Within 15 minutes, every left outfit in the media has it on their website. Within 10 minutes, every one of the mainstream media, their talking heads and their anchors are mouthing the exact same point. It doesn't matter if it's true. It doesn't matter if it's correct. It doesn't matter if it's unverified. It doesn't matter if it's unsourced. And within a few hours, you'll see communiques come out from the deep state, the shadow government that's still remaining at the FBI, the Department of Justice, the State Department, and other places, which echoes the exact same sentiments again, but in more bureaucratic speak. This is not coincidence. These people are in lockstep with one another. This is a program, not a program, but a program, as Comrade Stalin would call it. This is the big lie, as Goebbels from Nazi Germany would call it. My mouth is open. My jaw was on the floor for most of this week. And listen, I watch this stuff all the time, and I think I have a fairly good handle on it. So this memo, which many senior, current and past intelligence and FBI folks say does not disclose sources and uses, is accurate, and which was based on 1.2 million documents, which the FBI and DOJ tried not to give Congress for a year. This memo, which you and I have which we paid for, describing operations and nastiness, which we also paid for, and describing egregious breaches of constitutional rights and the rule of law by deep state and shadow government actors put in place by Barry and his cabal, who really thought Hillary was going to be elected and this would never be heard of again. This memo, which should have been in our hands to begin with. I mean, none of this stuff should have ever happened to begin with. The revelation of it happening should have been in our hands a year ago. And here we come down to the release of the memo. And like the Night of the Living Dead, the zombies who suddenly realize that there's people with guns coming for them, the entire complex of media, mainstream media, alt-left Democratic Party, deep state, and shadow government actors erupts in this desperate attempt to make sure that we, the American people, don't get to see our memo paid for with our dollars about our government and the abuses related to it. And it just went crazy. Let me give you some quotes here. So Adam Schiff comes out and says the memo's been altered. We then learn that, yeah, there was two punctuation deals. There was one word that the FBI wanted changed, and there were two word changes for syntax that the Democrats, including Adam Schiff, wanted. Those were the alterations to the memo. Mr. Schiff called them material alterations. The memo needs to go back to the committee, go through the entire, you know, in other words, the release of the memo to you and me, folks, because we don't count, is at least delayed for another month and gives them some more time to throw more stuff at it to maybe block its release. Then, there's just so much stuff here. Okay, then suddenly, Christopher Wray, Trump's appointment as the new head of the FBI to replace Comey, he goes over and finally on Sunday, this last Sunday, 6 days ago, and sees the memo. Monday, if you remember, Mr. McCabe got axed. Gee, you think there's any coincidence? Then suddenly, as the Democrats start to beat the drums about why the memo should not be released, national security, and, you know, it's putting the nation at risk, and identifying sources and uses, and there were these material changes, like, you know, putting in a comma. Suddenly, the deep state awakens. They said, let me give you some of the quotes here. I mean, I got stuff all over my desk here. They say that it will release sources and uses. It will undermine national security. It should be thoroughly reviewed by the DOJ and the FBI before being released. And then the corker of all, and this was just Thursday, Wray and Rosenstein being one of the targets in this memo, and who is, you know, who's a dirty cop, just like the other dirty cops that Obama installed as part of the shadow government at the heads, let me underline this, at the heads of these departments. Not rank and file, not the folks who protect us with their guns and badges. I'm talking about the corrupt top layer of the onion. And Rosenstein's right in there, and we'll talk about that as we come down to the memo. So no wonder he didn't want things released, right? No wonder. Anyway, Wray and Rosenstein then say on Thursday, well, if you're going to have to release the memo, as is becoming evident, Trump is going to ignore them, you have to redact all the names in the memo. Oh, really? Gee, Mr. Rosenstein, how come you want your name redacted? really? You know? And then Eric Holder is tweeting up a storm, you know, because he's named. And Comey is tweeting up a storm because he's named. The whole thing just stinks to high, high heaven. So top FBI and DOJ officials asked the Republicans not to release it. Then they claim that they have to review it before it gets released. Then when they see none of that's going to work, they go, well, if you're going to release it, you have to take out all the names. Ugh, unbelievable. Unbelievable. This, remember, folks, this is like in the last 4 days all this stuff has been going on. Okay. Then the mainstream media, the Democrats, and the deep state start talking about the fact that Trump, when he approved the appointment of Rosenstein as the deputy AG, had asked Rosenstein to, he wanted to know if he was on his team. So now they're waving around as a red herring the fact that this is really Trump's way to get rid of Rosenstein, and Rosenstein is in charge of Mueller, who's doing the Russian investigation, and blah, 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 blah. In other words, they're trying to twist the whole memo thing, exposing just a vestige of the corruption and anti-constitutional felonies that have occurred at the top levels of various departments of Obama's government and in the White House. We'll talk about that in a moment. You know, they're trying to tie it into the Russian thing and, you know, use that as a defense and all this kind of stuff. Well, let me give you a quote from Eric Holder when he was the Attorney General. Because, you know, if I was President of the United States, I'd want to know that the top people in the top departments, either at the cabinet level or directly below them, right? Jeff Sessions is the AG. He's in the cabinet. Rosenstein is his number two, right below him. I'd want to know that they are loyal to the office of the president and to the United States. I'd want to know that they don't hate me if I'm the president of the United States, and they're not going to go out of their way to stick it up my butt. I think that's a reasonable question, particularly given that over the last 8 years, the AGs Holder and Lynch basically did the exact bidding of Barack Obama in all sorts of nefarious and illegal ways, I might add. Let me give you a quote from Eric Holder. I'm still the president's wingman. Now, any of you who have been in the military, you know anything about the military or the Air Force, know that a wingman is the guy who protects you, and you protect him. So, suddenly, Eric Holder, with that quote in his past as to his buddy, boss, confidant, and fellow protector, Barry Obama, is now throwing out spaghetti that Trump wanting to know if Rosenstein is his man is obstruction of justice and interference with the Russian investigation. Okay. Then we come to Adam Schiff. I've given you a little taste of his despicable self earlier here in this segment. Okay, he claims the version that the White House reviewed was materially altered. Well, actually, folks, here's the deal. There were several grammatical and clarifying fixes. One change was requested by the FBI to protect a source and method concern, and one two-word change requested by the Democrats for accuracy are the changes to the memo. In other words, and by the way, the press picked it up, the deep state picked it up. This is all orchestrated, folks. All right. And of course, the left also resorted to their usual tactic, which is attacking Devin Nunes. If you remember, they got him removed as chairman of the committee because he was under investigation for a contrived ethics claim, which the Democrats brought up and the press heralded like 8 months ago. And that was completely thrown out. He took over again as head of the committee, and here comes this memo. So now they're going the same tactic. Nancy Pelosi comes out and tells Paul Ryan that he should remove Devin Nunes as head of the Intelligence Committee immediately. You know, now this is all Devin Nunes' fault. Okay, you bet. Also in this past week, there's a leak from the deep state that Peter Stroke, the great Peter Stroke, you know, the Peter Stroke of the Linda Gray extramarital affair, texting, blah, 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 exonerating Hillary, changing the Comey memo. I mean, you know, the list is endless. That Peter Stroke, because he's such a wonderful American, actually brought to McCabe's attention the emails that were found a month or two before the election on Uma Abedin, Clinton's top gal, on Uma Abedin's husband's, Anthony Weiner, the pervert, computer. Many of them classified documents. Now, the deep state doesn't tell you that that Strzok waited weeks to tell McCabe, and then McCabe buried it for 3 weeks before Comey finally had to come out with his letter like 11 days before the election saying, uh-oh, we found these emails. The emails were found months before, and they tried to hide them. Now, we're not to the bottom of this little portion of the story which just emerged this week, but we'll get there. So now you see the deep state and Strzok and the media are now trying to suddenly form a defense shield around Strzok. Well, you see, he was really, he brought these emails when they came out to everybody's attention. So he really wasn't biased. He didn't affect the Russian investigation. He really wasn't after Trump. He really didn't try and exonerate Hillary. You follow? I mean, it's unbelievable. It is unbelievable. And then, also this week, in trying to torpedo the memo before it comes out, there's another leak. There's a leak from the Mueller investigation, which, listen, folks, I've talked about Mueller in the past. Do not forget, I'm telling you this in advance, do not forget Uranium One, and do not forget the whole Hezbollah cocaine ring that Barack Obama ignored. Okay, I brought these up on previous shows. Don't forget that where it comes to Mueller. Nobody's really gone there yet, but I have a feeling we're going to get there. In any event, there's a leak from the Mueller team, just in the last few days, of course. This is to take the blunt off the memo and the red herring and distraction and Saul Alinsky, deny everything, admit nothing, distract. And so there's a high-ranking kind of press gal, public relations gal, in the White House by the name of Hope Hicks. And there's another attorney that was involved in there somewhere. It's kind of foggy. I don't have all the details for you. I'm just throwing it out, and I'll bring you more details in the future. So Corallo, supposedly, this attorney that was in the White House for a while, is supposedly going to tell Mueller that Hope Hicks told President Trump that Donald Jr.'s, see if you can follow this, folks, that Donald Jr.'s emails concerning his meeting with the Russians, remember that Russian meeting in Trump Tower, Manafort, Don Jr., and there was one other person there, whoever, with this Russian gal, that Hope Hicks had told President Trump that those emails, that is Don Jr.'s emails, the ones that he's already released, folks, he's released all his emails, that those emails will never see the light of day. So everybody's going, oh, here's the obstruction of justice, and, you know, it's way more important than this memo that's about to come out that shouldn't come out, the blah, 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 blah. You got it? In other words, the more confusing they can make this for you, and if you listen to me last 10 minutes, you're probably going, wow, man, where is he? What's going on here? That's their intention. Their intention is to blunt the information in this memo and to set up a foundation to fight the release of the information, the real intelligence, the real documents, the real stuff on which this memo was based, because it will sink a lot of ships. It will be the final torpedo in the floundering side of Obama's deep state and shadow government. And you know, there's no way to really take over the United States from within without controlling several key elements of the government. And there's no way the people are going to let you do it if they know it, i.e., and hence the deep state and the shadow government. All done in the dark, now being dragged, screaming, yelling, kicking, lying, threatening, and fighting into the light. Anyway, I'm going to follow that for you too, because now the press is saying, well, now Comey's going to have this huge leverage over Hope Hicks, and Hope Hicks knew everybody in the Trump White House, and now it's all going to come out. Okay. I'll tell you what's going to come. I'll tell you what came out. The memo. And that's just the beginning of it, folks. That's just the beginning of it. By the way, you know what else came out this week? You might have heard a little bit about this. There have been whispers about it in the past. But there's all sorts of stuff coming out. So what else came out in this week is that meeting that I was just talking about, where Don Jr. met with this Russian attorney, and Manafort was there and whoever else, in Trump Tower. Do you know where that attorney was an hour prior to her meeting with Donald Trump? At the offices of Fusion GPS, the outfit paid by Hillary Clinton to put together the fake dossier using Russian information for which it paid, that the FBI has used and which is referenced in the memo. And by the way, do you know where she went after the meeting with Don Jr. and Manafort, etc.? Back to the offices of Fusion GPS. Imagine that. More on that to come too, I'm sure. Now, what else has come out this week? I'm telling you, lots of stuff's going to be coming out. It's going to be like blinding. It's going to be like a rat-a-tat-tat. It's going to be like dominoes falling with concrete blocks attached to them. It now appears that McCabe appears to be the one who leaked the claims of President Trump looking to obstruct the Mueller investigation. In other words, McCabe folks, who realized that their whole attempt to frame Trump with a fake dossier, and who is involved with Rosenstein and others in the illegal, felonious, treasonous FISA warrants based on the Fusion GPS dossier paid for by Hillary, which they knew was false to begin with, but which they use as the pretext with their buddies in the media, you know, the whole cabal, the Democratic Party, the DNC, you name it, other folks in the deep state, Peter Strzok, etc., to get these warrants and to concoct this whole Trump-Russia collusion deal. McCabe seems to at some time realizing that's not going to go anywhere. Peter Strzok realized it before. Look at his tweets. There's no big there. I'm not even sure I want to be part of this investigation. McCabe leaked the claims of Trump looking to obstruct the Mueller investigation. McCabe is responsible for beginning, or at least being the front man for, this whole switch in direction by mainstream media, Democrats, and deep state to, okay, well, there's no Russian collusion, but there was obstruction of justice in the investigation of no Russian collusion. It now comes out that McCabe, and by the way, this is in Howard Kurtz's new book that's out called Media Madness. It now appears that McCabe, after coming up with the idea of let's switch this Russian collusion over to obstruction of justice, sets up Rance Priebus, at that time the chief of staff of the White House. Number one, he leaks a story to the New York Times. McCabe does. The New York Times runs the story about Trump obstruction of justice in the Mueller investigation. McCabe then calls Rance Priebus, meets with him privately in the White House, and tells him, this is all false, don't worry about the story, we know it's incorrect, blah, 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 blah. And Trump isn't under investigation anyway. Priebus asks him, well, if you know the story's wrong, can you at least say something about it? That the FBI disavows, you know, the points made by the New York Times in the story? McCabe tells him he's going to check on it. And then calls him back and says, nope, nothing we can do. You know, I've been told not to say anything. Mr. Comey's going to talk to you. So Jim Comey goes over and talks to Rance Priebus. They go through the same little charade. Trump isn't under investigation. There's nothing to worry about. This New York Times article is false. But, gee, there's just nothing that we can say publicly about it. Then McCabe and Comey plant another story in another illegal leak. You can't leak. It's a felony to leak stuff about an investigation, folks. They plant another story taking the situation that they purposely and with premeditation set up. And the New York Times comes out with a story that Rance Priebus went to them, not them to him, told them the story was false and demanded that they get the story taken care of. Do you understand how insidious this is? Do you understand what kind of planning goes into this? Do you understand what an affront to you, me, America, American values, the Constitution, and the rule of law is? Do you understand that this is an attempt at continuation of the coup d'etat that Trump has brought into the light that has, at least for now, while he's president, failed? This is how to reestablish that coup d'etat or continue it through absolute subterfuge. By top people in the government against our own government and against the electoral process. It's just outrageous. So now you see the origins of the whole obstruction of justice stuff and how it was a premeditated setup by McCabe and Comey. And that's just come out this week. Wow. I mean, barn burner. But that's not all, folks. What has also come out this week is that suddenly, do you remember Kerry's discussion with the Palestinians last week? Don't pay attention to Donald Trump, hold strong, don't do anything he wants, blah, 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 blah. Okay, well, the State Department under Kerry, at the orders of Obama, this has all come out this week too. Let me quote, those documents show the Obama State Department under John Kerry gathered and sent its own dossier, this is an additional dossier over Fusion GPS, of classified information on Russia to Senator Ben Cardin, a political ally in the U.S. Senate to undermine President Trump, unquote. That's from Judicial Watch, Tom Fitton, by the way. Judicial Watch will pursue information on who pulled this classified information, who authorized this release, and why it was evidently dumped just days before President Trump's inauguration. By the way, what has also come out this week relative to Kerry's State Department is that they had some kind of contact with and potentially assisted Steele in some way, shape, or form in putting together the Fusion GPS dossier. Byron York, Washington Examiner. The Obama State Department is now being probed as to whether or not they had a hand in the dossier. This is the Steele dossier. Steele was viewed inside the Obama State Department as a valuable source for intelligence on all things Russia. Obama state officials made a habit of disseminating reports the former British spy authored for private clients around the department. Private clients. I wonder if there's a link to private clients? How do you have private clients in the State Department? Oh, wait a minute. You mean private clients getting stuff from the State Department who are really private clients of the Clinton Foundation? I guess we'll find out. Huh. I guess we'll find out. By the way, so the FBI and the DOJ, after Schiff lays the path, the media picks it up. They then come out with statements here just in the last two or three days. You got to redact the names. I've already talked about that. They came out with another statement. Quote, we have grave concerns about the material omissions of fact that fundamentally impact the memo's accuracy. James Clapper, remember the guy who lied under oath to Congress and said that no Americans were being surveilled? He didn't know anything about it. Releasing the memo is, quote, a very serious affront to the FBI. is kind of an assault on the principles of the FBI, unquote. I want you to think about that oxymoron. The memo that reveals to us once and for all, black and white, based on $1.2 million pages of documentation put together by the IG, who reveals the lack of principles at the head, at the top layers of the FBI and in the DOJ, so that we can clean it up. Clapper is turning that around, as progressives do, and saying that cleaning up the lack of principles is an attack on the principles. Wow. Wow. And of course, Schiff, he jumped up and down Thursday night. The Republicans, quote, immediately withdraw the document that it sent to the White House. All right. Well, you know, you can go on and on with the hysteria here. By the way, Devin Nunes sent back a basically told the FBI, Schiff and everybody else to shove it in a really, really strong and nasty memo. And I'm not going to bore you with that because I think people have gone over it in the media. Oh, my producer's nodding at me. I should read it? I'll read it. All right. Here's Nunes' memo back at them with all this crap coming out. Quote, it's clear that top officials use unverified information in a court document to fuel a counterintelligence investigation during an American political campaign. Once the truth gets out, we can begin taking steps to ensure our intelligence agencies and courts are never misused like this again. Okay. Oh, by the way, the Justice Department came out, I think on Wednesday, and said it would be extraordinarily reckless to release the memo. This was written by another deputy AG. Now, folks, I'll bet you dinner. I'll bet you a lot more dinner that Rod Rosenstein walked on down the hall with a nervous twitch in his face, went into another deputy AG's office and said, listen, I can't write this memo because, you know, I think I'm in the memo and I'm kind of a target of the memo and they kind of, you know, I'm like in trouble, but you got to write a memo saying not to release this. So this memo comes from like a deputy AG you've never heard of all of a sudden, right? It's extremely reckless to release the memo. Yeah, okay. Whatever. Hey, Jeff Sessions, where the hell are you? Knock, knock. Anybody home? All right. Now, the other thing we learn, I mean, it goes on and on and on. It's unbelievable. The other thing we learn, if you remember, do you remember the interviews that Barry Obama had with a whole bunch of TV stations? Number one, he said, just like the IRS thing, right? He said, oh, no, I didn't hear anything about Hillary's private server. The first thing I heard about it was in the news. Remember that? Do you remember those interviews he had where he talks about, they didn't call it an investigation, Lynch called it a matter, the Hillary Clinton matter? Quote, she did nothing illegal, unquote. Quote, there was no intent, unquote, which, by the way, is not a standard on the espionage laws. Quote, I'm confident she will be cleared, unquote. Do you remember all that leading up to the election? This is in like the 6 months prior to the election. Do you remember Hillary Clinton out on the trail saying, I'm confident there will be nothing. I know that nothing will happen. I know that the nothing will be found. Well, how do you think Barry and Hillary knew, folks? When they actually knew that all sorts of felonies, breaches of espionage, treason, etc., was taking place at the time. How do you think they knew? Because they were walking in lockstep, obviously, with the deep state and the shadow government. And the order was, you will clear Hillary. Now, many people will ascribe that to simply politics, but it's much deeper than that. Much. It always is, isn't it? So let me tell you the depths to which we will now sink. Barack Obama knew damn well that Hillary Clinton had a private email server and that she was breaking the law. In fact, Barack Obama, under a pseudonym so he couldn't be identified, wrote emails, classified emails, exchanged classified information with Hillary Clinton at her private email address that went through her private server, and he knew it. He knew it. In fact, right after the elections, before Trump took office. Barry, baby. Because now, oh my God, Trump got elected. We can't bury this whole thing forever. Barry had his email communications with Clinton sealed. He called it presidential records privilege. Huh. Yeah, okay. And of course, the media plays right along with it. So Obama was able to sidestep disclosure without acknowledging that the emails that he had lied about to begin with contained classified information. And number two, he could avoid using the term executive privilege, which kind of raises all sorts of red flags. You know, Watergate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, he could invoke the straw man, since it was now clear all this stuff had happened, that Clinton had not intended to harm national security, and that he doubts it was harmed. I mean, exactly the opposite, by the way, of the drafts of the Comey memo that Comey, Stronicki, McCabe, and Strzok then altered to delete. In fact, the original Comey memo, we come to learn, exonerating Hillary, had reference to Obama's emails to Hillary. That was completely taken out of the final draft. Wow. Imagine that. All right. Well, look. During this time, Loretta Lynch told Comey to call it a matter. On July 1, Lynch meets with Bill Clinton on the tarmac down there in Arizona. And Rebicki, I'm sorry, mispronounced his name. By the way, I mispronounced Lisa Page's name last week too, excuse me. It doesn't matter, right? They're treasonous scum that need to be prosecuted. Whatever their names are, it's irrelevant, to be honest with you. The original Comey memo, this is all happening at the same time, okay? Obama is saying she's clear. Hillary's saying she's confident. The tarmac meeting, the revisions to the Comey memo that he started 3 months before, all this is going on like in the June-July time period. Do you understand? I mean, they were beginning to realize they could lose. Now they're scurrying around like the scum they are, trying to cover their tracks and make sure Hillary doesn't get indicted so that she can beat Donald Trump and none of this would ever come out. In other words, folks, this was not prompted. It was only partially prompted by politics. This was prompted by self-preservation or attempts at self-preservation by traitors. I mean, the best way to escape a crime is to make sure nobody ever knows about the crime. And to make sure that nobody knows about the crime, the best way to do it is have somebody in there who won't investigate and will sweep it under the carpet. Hillary Clinton was that person. And Donald Trump obviously was not. Do you remember what else happened right around that time? The debates. You remember Donald Trump, I think was in the second debate, saying, "You should be in jail, and when I'm president, you will be." Don't think that didn't catch the attention of the deep state and all these players, and Obama. I want you to know that Comey's original memo, it's now come out, said the president, that means Obama, had emailed classified information back and forth with Hillary on the server. That was replaced. First of all references to the emails were taken out. And secondly, The words the president were taken out of this memo. And by the way, I'm talking about the exoneration memo. The words were taken out of the memo. All right. And by the way, when I'm talking about the memo, in this case, I'm talking about the exoneration memo that Comey began drafting in May, that Peter Strzok, Rebicki, McCabe then altered to get Hillary off the hook and therefore try and conceal their own activities. You understand how what was going on here? Wow. And Barack Obama's activities, probably at Barack Obama's express orders. So anyway, the words the president were taken out of the memo and they were replaced with, quote, another senior government official. So the effort to obscure Obama's involvement is obvious, although it had a flaw. Obviously, anybody reading that memo at some point in the future would want to know who the other senior government official was, but I guess then they could decide then who they were going to throw under the bus to save Obama. Anyway, just unbelievable. Now listen, I could keep going, but I have limited time, but that will give you an idea of the stuff which has bubbled to the surface of the scummy swamp pond just in the last 5 days. And that's just part of it. That's just part of it. What it points to is really kind of the gist of the show. And that is that these people care not at all about America, American values, the Constitution, the rule of law, you, me, our families, nothing. They don't care. And the other thing that happened this week, which was in your face about the values, or shall we say lack of American values, of the alt-left progressive, also known as the Democratic Party, was a State of the Union speech. If you have not seen that speech, you should, for three reasons. Number one, it was a great speech. Trump hit it out. It was grand slam. Number two, it will tell you, because Trump is right up front and in your face, what Trump plans to do. And number three, because while you watch that speech, which I did twice, my senior producer did once, I want you to watch the Democratic side of the chamber at various points. Now, many of the media outlets, left and right, well, not so much left, but on the right or in the middle, have pointed out some glaring examples of the Democrats not applauding or rising. For instance, the tearjerker. The two black, nice black couples from Suffolk County, Long Island, in tears up there as Trump is talking about their two daughters that were killed by, brutally killed, I might add, by MS-13 gang members. Illegal aliens. Do you know that none of the Democrats would stand up and applaud those people? Not even the Black Caucus. Two black couples who lost their children. They couldn't even give them respect. And everybody has talked about that. And everybody's talked about the fact that when Trump cites the lowest unemployment in history for Hispanics and blacks, none of the Hispanic Democrats clapped or stood up. And none of the Black Caucus stood up, and one member of that 40-member caucus clapped. One. So you've heard about all those glaring examples, but what we did was we put together a complete, well, I'm not sure you can be complete, but an extensive, a comprehensive list of things that Donald Trump brought up in that speech that are not political. They are not left. They are not right. They are simply American. They are good for America and Americans, whether you are left, you are right, you are black, you are white, you are red, you are yellow, it doesn't matter. You know, like a job, that's a good thing, no matter who you are. A raise, that's a good thing, no matter who you are. A bonus, that's a good thing, no matter who you are. Let me give you the examples very quickly, and you will shake your head. You will shake your head. So, Apple and Exxon together bringing in $400 billion of investment, hiring tens of thousands of new jobs, hundreds of millions of dollars in bonuses, increases in giving to charity, increases in wages and benefits. They did not stand. Did not stand. It is a time when everybody can strive for the American dream. They did not stand. We should stand for the national anthem. They did not stand. The young kid who noticed there were no graves on the flags of veterans, 12-year-old kid who was in the audience, Trump did a masterful job of having people in the audience and weaving them into his story. This 12-year-old kid, Redding, California, noticed his grandfather didn't have a flag on his veteran's grave and put together a program himself, and now has 40,000 flat on 40,000 military graves. I mean, that's remarkable. They didn't stand. I mean, they didn't stand. New plants, new car manufacturing plants by Toyota and Nissan, and I believe Chrysler or Chevy, one or the other, moving a huge plant from Mexico to either Georgia or Mississippi. They didn't stand. I mean, I had to watch it twice to really believe what I was seeing. Not only didn't they stand, I'm going to interject for just a moment. If you take a look, if you watch that speech, they're panning to the faces of these various Democrats, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, other people in the Black Caucus. You have to see it. Nothing I can tell you will describe what your eyes will show you. He's going to lower the cost of drugs by empowering generic drug companies to move against pharmaceuticals. They didn't stand. Remember, and I've talked about this, you go back to my shows, put in Obamacare drugs. To get Obamacare passed, Barry Obama, not giving a damn about the people of America or your pocketbooks, obviously, cut an $80 billion deal with Big Pharma. And that was, he wasn't going to allow or promote generic drugs so that the Big Pharma boys would have no competition. Trump is reversing that, which is good for you and me and our pocketbooks. They didn't stand. Terminally ill patients will have the right to try experimental drugs without all the usual BS and regulation at home so they can try to live. They didn't stand. Infrastructure. Now, how long have the Democrats folks been jumping up and down about infrastructure? Hell, Obama did a failed $830 billion, whatever it was, deal. We find out later that 70% of the money, just like everything else in his crooked government, went to his left-wing buddies. It had nothing to do with infrastructure. So now we have a president who wants to do a $1.5 trillion infrastructure plan. The Democrats can't stand up and clap. Never mind the jobs, the money, the improvements of the country. Who cares, right? Listen to these words. These are Trump's exact words. I thought it was one of the best parts of his speeches. People will have, it is our goal to lift everybody, all Americans, and now, quote, from poverty to prosperity, from dependence to independence, and from welfare to work, unquote. Now, is there any American, left, right, or up, down, I mean, it doesn't matter. Is there any American that you can think of that moving from welfare to work is bad? How about moving from dependence to independence? How about moving from poverty to prosperity? The Democrats did not stand or applaud. And by the way, they didn't applaud at this stuff either. I mean, they did not just stand. These examples I'm giving you, with the exception of one or two, had no applause or no applause at all. Never mind, not standing. He calls for everybody, for Americans to get together, quote, Americans of every background, color, and creed, unquote. They didn't stand or clap. They didn't stand or clap for his suggested 2 million person path to citizenship for illegal aliens. You know, listen, I would have understood if they sat right down and didn't clap for the wall, and didn't clap for the end of chain migration, didn't clap for the end of the visa lottery. I mean, that's a left-right thing, right? I mean, I think it's an American thing, but I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. But you can't stand and clap for your own constituencies. Your own constituents, three more than you asked for, 3x more than you asked for, having a path to citizenship? Whew, unbelievable. They didn't stand and clap for border security or the example he had of a border security hero in the audience. They did not stand, obviously, for when he said America first in international relationships. They did not stand when he talked about how they were going to become even tougher on drug dealers and pushers. No stand, no clap. They did stand, however, one of the very few occasions they did, when he talked about prison reform. I'm not sure how you can not stand for both of those, but who knows? They did not stand for new rules of engagement by the military, which will save military lives and speed victory in armed conflict. They did not stand for ISIS being knocked back 98% in its geographic holdings. They did not stand for that, folks. And you don't think there's an unholy alliance between the alt-left and the Islamists, huh? They did not stand for Jerusalem being named as the capital of Israel. They did not stand for foreign aid now going only to our friends and not anymore to our enemies. They did not stand for sanctions on Iran, Cuba, and Venezuela. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Venezuela here at the end of the, toward the end of the show. They did not stand for 3 million, it's now up from that, 3 million people as of a week ago, it's now about 4 million, getting $1,000 to $3,000 bonuses from their employers. They did not stand for shortening FDA approval for certain types of drugs from years to 1 year. They did not stand, folks, for the American flag, and they did not stand at Trump's words that the Capitol, it was done very well at the end of the speech, that the Capitol is a monument to the people of the United States, and that we, in other words, him and the entire Congress, are there to serve those people in their monument. They did not stand for that. They did not stand for a whole new, very well capitalized plan for job training. They did not stand for the words, Americans are dreamers too. I guess you and I don't have any dreams, and if we do, they don't count. They did not stand for the words, come together for the people. These are the people we were elected to serve. They did not stand for that. Wow. They did not stand for the motto, in God we trust. I guess you could maybe let them off the hook on that one, because to the alt-left, their enemies are faith, freedom, the Constitution, and the family. So I'll give them a slide. We'll call that political. But if you take all the stuff that's been going on in the memo, and I just dented it for you, all the stuff that's going on with this exposure of deep state, shadow government, treason, and corruption, if you take the concerted and focused and coordinated intentional lies by the media, the deep state, and the Democrats, and you take what happened just Tuesday night. This is just 5 days ago, folks. Everything I've been talking about has happened in the last 6 days since my last show. It's unbelievable. And I didn't even get to, I didn't even dent it. If you take all that stuff together, it is clear as a bell that everything I have been telling you for years about the Democratic Party, quote unquote, the Democratic Party, is true and correct. They are the enemies of the Constitution. They are the enemies of the rule of law, except where its twisting can help them with personal power, greed, corruption, protection, escaping prosecution for crimes or ideology. And they are the enemies of American citizens. I know enemies is a strong word, and I know traitors is a strong word, but I urge you, just take a few of the snippets I brought up that have occurred prior to the release of this memo. Take a look at the memo, which we're going to discuss, and what it tells us, and it's just the tip of the iceberg. Watch that State of the Union speech. It's a great speech, but watch that Democratic side of the aisle. And please, you write me or put a comment on the website or on Facebook if you come away with any other conclusion after doing your own research and seeing with your own eyes this stuff just in the last week. Just in the last week. All right. Well, listen. As a little tickler for next week, because I want to kind of spend the last part of the show talking about the memo. Next week, I'm going to, about half the show, depending upon what occurs, I guess, in the week between now and then, about half the show, at least a third to a half of the show, is going to be on the economy. It is going to be kind of an adjunct to my Canaries in the Economic Coal Mine show I did 2 or 3 weeks ago, which got rave reviews, and which brought to light all sorts of economic factors and canaries that you should be watching for the sake of you and your family. Because underneath the wine and roses of an economy, which, by the way, is now at an annualized GDP rate of 5.4%, you heard it here first. I told you 3 months ago we're going to see 5% GDP under this president. Everybody laughed. Hell, everybody laughed that you'd see 3. We are at an annualized rate, according to the Wharton School of Business, just came out for January of 2018, of 5.4% GDP. That is smoking. I mean, smoking. And that's the wine and roses level. But underneath the wine and roses level, folks, is a table. A table on which the good food of a roaring economy is set. And my show 2 weeks ago, Canaries in the Economic Coal Mine, is about that table. And I'm going to bring more stuff to light for you. It's going to be an adjunct. You'll find it fascinating next week. I'm going to tell you why your deposits in banks are not safe, while the cash you have in banks that you think is insured is quite the contrary. Why it's not your money under law. This is not like paranoid tinfoil stuff. This is the law. And I'm going to throw this stuff out. You need to do what you need to do after you listen to the information and assimilate it. But I will bring up in this context for this show, Venezuela, 15 years of socialist government. Hey, Bernie, are you listening, Bernie, Hillary, Barry? And I'm going to talk more about this in the context of next week's show. But let me just tell you that right now, Venezuela is in collapse. Collapse. The average minimum wage in Venezuela is now $1.83 a month. A month. And that's after 5 minimum wage hikes during 2017. It's at $1.83 a month. The bolivar, which is their currency, the bolivar, is worth less than 1 United States penny. So an average Venezuelan worker, I want you to think about this for a moment, is receiving approximately 1 cent, 1 United States penny, per hour in a minimum wage job, which happens to be the lowest minimum wage on the planet. And they have Hugo Chavez and now Nicolas Maduro, both totalitarian dictators and socialists, who, by the way, have billions in their overseas accounts, or at the time Chavez died, he did. They figure that the average three-fourths of the adult population in Venezuela unintentionally lost an average of 19 pounds each last year, and 82% of the households live in poverty. Once again, I'm going to talk more about this next week. I'm just giving you something to think about here. And at the same time that we hear all this, there's an article this past week, which, of course, nobody's talking about, well, obviously. I did a show. It was a two-part show. If you put in state finances, I believe those shows will come up. And they were just 4, 5, 6 months ago. They were extremely well received. And I went down those states which are basically insolvent, those states which are stable, and I gave you the reasons for each and every one of them. I told you that the three worst and is New York, Illinois, and California. The next worst were like Connecticut and several others, and there was actually one red state in there too. But almost all of them blue states run by Democrats for years and years and years. It's the same thing with the big cities, right? Detroit, Baltimore, Chicago, you name it. This article just came out this week. So Illinois, and I've also talked about, by the way, the fact that people vote with their feet. That people are leaving these high tax states, now particularly spurred because of the new tax law where they can't deduct the exorbitant taxes they're charged by the state, by the poorly run state government from their federal taxes. People are leaving these states in droves. Connecticut has net out-migration a lot. New York has net out-migration. California, if you take out illegal immigration, has net out-migration of United States citizens. And Illinois, we now find out, has net out-migration. There is one person leaving Illinois every 4.3 minutes. So many people that the state dropped from the fifth place to the sixth in terms of overall population, that's kind of a huge deal, folks. As I told you in my stories about Illinois, who I pointed out was the most broke, not most broke, it was broke. It was insolvent. It couldn't pay its current $16 billion in operating bills. And one of the reasons is that pensions, were locked in through all the corruption in the Democratic, it's like everywhere. If there's Democrats, there's corruption. And by the way, Republicans aren't off the hook in that either. But decades ago, public employee unions, they lobbied and they got, because, you know, they have all this voting power, right? And the Democrats want to stay in power. They got an amendment to the state constitution, which means you can't cut pensions. Then they negotiated outrageous pensions. In other words, The politicians, Democratic politicians, were taking from the taxpayers to pay the unions, who then came out and voted for the Democratic, age-old thing, right? So, what is Illinois doing? They are raising $107 billion in new debt, right? They are underwater. They are in debt. They're going to go out and take more debt. This is like one of us being bankrupt with all our credit cards maxed out, and our solution is go out and get a new credit card. And just like we would face, because of our lousy credit, a ridiculously high rate on the new credit card, so too will Illinois face ridiculously high rates on this incredibly moronic additional debt, which, of course, will compound the problem. And, of course, the other thing they did is what Democrats do. A 32%, listen to me now, a 32% hike in income tax for Illinois residents. Boy, it's no wonder they're going down the tube and people are leaving the state. We're going to talk a little bit more about this next week also. Because it all ties into what we're going to discuss relative to the economy and some more canaries that you need to be watching out for in your own personal economic mind. And now we come to the final segment of this whirlwind show following the tumultuous week, which was capped off by the release of the memo, quote unquote, the memo. Now, I've already told you about all the hoopla and snafu and trumped up, no pun intended, nonsense on both sides, particularly the hysteria on the part of the Democrats. And you have probably heard in passing on the radio, TV, wherever, pretty much what this memo contained. Under the treason section on the website, on the rightsideradio.com, several articles are posted, which kind of boils down the memo, at least relative to that writer's perspective. And the memo itself is posted, in case you haven't had a chance to read it. I noticed on a number of sites it was kind of difficult to get to, and you had to do PDF. Anyway, I think we've solved that for you. At least I hope I did. And you should be able to read it and interpret it for yourself. Let me tell you what I think. And it's a much bigger picture than this memo. I mean, this memo is really kind of the beginning. It's the beginning. It's like Trump's election was the beginning of the real, of the end battle for the Republic. This memo is the beginning of the end of the deep state. But it's just the beginning. So the takeaways I get from this memo in reading it, and a lot, and the several articles that I read, several, four or five, didn't pick up on some of these points. I want to point them out to you as you read the memo for yourself. So, basically, and I think we're going to find some more FISA stuff out there. And I believe that we're going to find more abuses of FISA out there. And the submittals to the FISC, you know, that's the FISA review court. My take on this memo was, to be honest, it was not as nuclear as the Republicans had led you to believe, and it was nowhere near the nothing burger that the Democrats wanted you to believe. And the one thing I will absolutely tell you, it was not a risk to national security at all. That was a blatant lie by the Democrats, the mainstream media, the FBI, and the DOJ, period. In that respect, this memo was a nothing burger. And the hue and the cry and the din over, oh, releasing sources and methods. There were no sources and methods that aren't common knowledge and that have not been previously released that are in this memo. I mean, this was absolutely contrived nonsense. And further undermined the credibility of the hysterical Dems and their mistress, the mainstream media, if there's any credibility left. And I might add, underscored the feeling of unease, the lack of trust that I personally feel, and I believe you probably feel, in terms of the institutions of government, such as the FBI, the DOJ, the State Department. I mean, some of these venerable institutions, which in the past we've kind of trusted. This memo, the clarifications and the reinforcement that this memo gave to things which I brought to your attention a year ago, it underlines that diminishing confidence in those outfits. And by the way, diminishing confidence with cause. I want to bring you back to just about a year ago, in fact, January. And this, remember all the stuff that was going on before Trump's inauguration, and the mainstream press was trying to tell you how Obama was bending over backwards to give a smooth transition. And I told you this is all nonsense. This is all smokescreen. Obama is doing everything he can to sabotage this. They have FISA warrants. I told you about it then because there were whispers of it in these back channel newsletters that I get. They have FISA warrants. They obtained them improperly. And this is a deep state sand trap that's been set for Trump. I mean, I told you that a year ago. And listen, Sean Hannity was on it also. But he didn't start talking about it till March. I was actually 3 months ahead of him on this. In any event, the memo itself, I'm going to divide this into two pieces. The memo, and I'm going to talk about some things that all these other articles and pundits and talking heads just don't seem to be picking up on, which I think are really important as you read this memo. And number two, what this memo means. Big picture, stratospheric. What I think is going to happen in the coming weeks, months, maybe, unfortunately, the coming year or two. Because there's some big effects that the release of this memo, that the exposure of the corruption, the disregard for the American people, the thwarting of the Constitution, the attempted escape from the constitutionally provided for oversight by Congress. There's going to be ramifications to this, folks. You know, there is never an action without a reaction, and on and on and on. And I think in the end, it's going to be good, but it's going to be a bumpy, bumpy ride, and I'll explain to you what I mean here as we finish up the show. First of all, the memo itself. There were four FISA-related matters discussed in this memo. The first was an application, give or take, April of 2016. They used Carter Page, mainly because they had looked at him in 2013 for some dealings they thought he had had with the Russians, and I think he was a convenient scapegoat. As we have suspected, and as I've told you, the bogus Steele dossier, the Fusion GPS dossier, you know, with the Russian prostitutes, you know, doing the golden shower on a bed and in the hotel, whatever nonsense, was indeed, this memo cements it. Fusion GPS, Steele was paid $160,000 to write this memo through his Russian contacts by Fusion GPS. In addition, although nobody else is talking about it, if you read this memo, I think it's pretty clear that he was also paid by the FBI. You know, that's a question that's been out there a long time. You read the memo and you tell me what you think it says. So, it also comes to light that Steele was hugely biased against Trump and that his cohort, the number four at the DOJ, or an assistant attorney general, whose wife, Nellie, worked for Fusion GPS on this dossier, was kind of his inroad to the DOJ, getting the memo in there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the first FISA warrant was based almost solely on this memo. And not on this memo, excuse me, based on the dossier. And this memo makes it clear that the dossier had not been vetted at all at the time it went into the FISA court. Under FISA law, you have to renew a FISA application for a FISA warrant, that is, to spy on an American, every 90 days. And you've probably heard this from all the talking heads on TV, but it's true. You know, the FISA court, the judge, can only make a decision on what he or she has presented. You may remember that I brought up, I thought it was really curious, that there was a judge about 3 months ago. I don't know exactly what show it was, but it was, I think it was back in November sometime, maybe October. And I mentioned on air here that I found it peculiar that one of the judges, who was also thought to be a FISA court judge, they're kept very secret, one of the federal judges had recused herself, it was a gal, if I remember correctly, from several court cases kind of involving this matter, Manafort, some other stuff. I thought that was really odd. And it occurred to me at that time, and I brought it up on the radio show, that that judge was probably the judge that they had gone to for these, as we can now see, illegally obtained and illegally issued, no fault of the judge, FISA warrants. And it's going to be really interesting to see what she does. Because in submitting false applications for a FISA warrant, and remember, falsity can occur from two things. You can out and out lie. In other words, you can state with your mouth or in writing something that you know to be untrue. That is a misrepresentation. That is a lie. Or you can lie by omission. You know of a material fact that would change the context of a presentation. But rather than change the context, you intentionally omit that material fact that you know, and that is also a lie, particularly under law. And lying to a court any court, never mind a federal court in D.C., is a really, really, really big no-no, particularly if you are an attorney. All sorts of nasty things can happen, like up to 10 years in the hoosegow, contempt of court, huge fines, loss of your license to practice law, and I can go down, I mean, it's a laundry list. And particularly in a high-profile case like this, you know, you piss off a judge, you're gonna have a really bad day. So it's going to be really interesting to see what she does now that this memo is out, and it's apparent that she was schnookered. And she must have had an inkling of what was going on, you know, with the kind of swamp that D.C. is, for her to recuse herself. And I don't have any proof, by the way. We don't have any name on the judge. But I have a feeling that we will find that this judge, who kind of mysteriously, suddenly recused herself on these Mueller, DOJ, Russia, Trump matters that were before her, you know, common cases, not FISA cases. I have a feeling she was the FISA judge, and we'll see what she does. The other thing that came to light in these memos is who signed these. And, you know, once again, I told you, oh, wow, this is probably back around mid-2017. I told you that Rod Rosenstein was a problem. I didn't trust him. I smelled a rat. There was just nothing about him that I liked. And, you know, I don't know the guy. I haven't met him. All I have is various news sources. But what I also had was his inability, whether intentional or incompetence, to make any decision to control Mueller. I didn't like it when he wrote the, shall we say, the framework of the Mueller special investigation, which was like totally open-ended. It wasn't specifically focused on, you will investigate any collusion, treasonous activities, whatever, between Trump or any of his team and the Russians. It was like, you're going to investigate that, and you can also investigate anything else you want. I didn't like that at all. That was a big red flag for me. And now we find out from the memo that James Comey, who I told you a long time ago and almost before anyone else was a dirty cop, that James Comey signed three FISA applications. Our buddy Andrew McCabe, you know, he who got Hillary campaign money in Virginia, signed one. The acting attorney general, by the way, I brought this up to you, too. Do you remember that acting attorney general, while Jeff Sessions was getting hung up in the Senate over that nonsense and making the very poor decision to recuse himself from all things Russia, the Department of Justice was being run by a gal by the name of Sally Yates. Do you remember that name? And I kept kind of wailing and moaning about her because, you know, she was an Obama appointee. It was like having a wolf in the hen house. And sure enough, that is the AG, if you remember, when Trump came out with his first travel ban, she is the AG who stood up and said, I'm not going to implement it, which, of course, Trump then fired her. But she's also the assistant AG that called up the Trump White House in November, thereabouts. Actually, it was probably before then, but called up the Trump. Oh, this is around transition time. That's right. It's back around January of 2017. Man, I can't believe only a year's passed. January 2017. This is like right around the time Trump is getting inaugurated, almost 1 year ago. And she started pumping the Trump campaign full of all sorts of nasty stuff about his national security advisor at that time, who was later indicted, if you remember, by Robert Mueller for lying to the FBI. Of course, Uma Abedin has, and Cheryl Mills have, and Hillary has. I mean, I can go down the list. I'm not going to beat that horse right now. That's for another time. But anyway, this poor guy was indicted. And Sally Yates did everything in her power to have the Trump team fire him, and they did. And I've often wondered how Sally Yates knew who was saying what to whom so that she could be calling Trump to undermine his new national security advisor. Well, now we know, because Sally Yates signed one of these FISA applications also. Imagine that. And Sally Yates was, of course, at the DOJ during the whole time this fusion GPS nonsense was going on. And during the time that Loretta Lynch was there meeting with Bill on the tarmac. Sally Yates is a dirty cop. Another acting deputy attorney general by the name of Dana Buente, whom we haven't heard about, but I think we're going to hear more about, also signed one of the applications. And our old buddy, the guy that I haven't trusted for a long time, Rod Rosenstein, also signed one of the applications. In fact, the Rosenstein signature is really quite curious because, and this comes out of the memo also, let me give you this timeline. Nobody's giving you a time. They're saying this and that. Let me give you a timeline. It's really important. So, give or take, in September of 2016, Christopher Steele is being paid by Hillary Clinton and her campaign in the DNC. He's also collecting moolah from Comey at the FBI. He's manufactured this completely fake Russian dossier. The FBI hasn't checked it out, but they're already beginning to suspect, which is also in the memo, that it's a bunch of hooey. Yet they continue to employ him to get quote-unquote intelligence from the Russians. Wow. And in September, he sits down with and gives several interviews to the press, including one to a reporter. I forget the guy's name. It's in the memo, Borelius or something like that. It doesn't matter. The timeline is what's important. The FBI finds out that he's given these interviews. I think at that time, they have also found out that this dossier that they had already obtained two FISA warrants on and begun the whole Trump stuff. You know, Hillary had just been exonerated. Now they were turning their sights to Trump. You know, the insurance policy that Peter Strzok texted about talking with his girlfriend Paige and Andy, that is Andrew McCabe's office. I mean, it all ties in, right? This is all happening at the same time. So this is September of 2016. Yahoo, this reporter at Yahoo, comes out with a story on the dossier, basically realleging all the BS facts in it. And in October, I believe it was October 26th, around October 16th, let me back up, around October 16th, somebody at the FBI, whether it was Comey or somebody else, calls Steele in and says, you're done. You're fired. We're not going to pay you anymore. We don't want you to do any more work for us. You broke the rules because you've talked to the press. And you go, you think to yourself, oh, well, maybe these guys had like a vestige of, you know, honor and rules. But then on October 26, folks, listen to this. They go back in. And this is Comey and his motley crew who just let Steele go because he's an unreliable source, has given them bad stuff, and has also broken the rules and talked to the press on it. They go back into the FISA court and they renew the FISA application for the extension of the warrant on October 26, using once again the dossier, the Steele dossier, which they've already internally completely discredited. They don't tell the FISA court this. They don't tell the FISA court Steele's being paid by the DNC or anybody else. And they use the article from Yahoo. Listen to this now. They canned Steele for talking to Yahoo, so they knew about it. But they used the article that the reporter wrote at Yahoo, which is basically a regurgitation of Steele's, what they knew was a fake dossier, to go in on October 26 and renew the application. It gets worse. On or about January 6th, Donald Trump's been elected now. Now, he's no longer a candidate. He's the president-elect. And you know who goes in to renew the application? Rod Rosenstein. On January 6th. Using the same dossier and using, once again, the article from the Yahoo reporter to misle the court into thinking that there's now a second source, when the second source was a regurgitation of what was in the dossier, because the story came from an interview with Steele that all these people who were signing these applications already knew had been canned because the information was bad and because he broke the rules and talked to the reporter at Yahoo. You can't make this stuff up. That's a big takeaway. Those names, the people that signed these applications, is a big takeaway. What happened over the four applications with Yahoo and Steele and them finding out this whole thing was nonsense is a big deal. And it was accentuated by the fact that Comey goes into Trump's office, like right around the time of the inauguration or right after it, shows him the dossier and tells him, we know that this is false and salacious, and you know, but we want you to see it. And also tells Trump he's not under investigation. Comey later lies about that under oath to Congress. Let me read you something. Oh, Michael Isikoff is a gentleman in Yahoo News. Michael Isikoff. Let me quote this. The article does not corroborate the Steele dossier because it is derived from information leaked by Steele himself to Yahoo News. The Page FISA application, incorrectly assesses that Steele did not directly provide the information to Yahoo News. So by this time, the third or fourth reapplication of the FISA, which nobody's picking up on in this memo, not only was the FBI and DOJ colluding and lying to the FISA court by omission, in other words, not telling the court material facts, but they had actually progressed to the point of lying by statement, by representation. They told the court that this was a second source in Yahoo. It's a scary deal. Scary deal. All right. So, and while I may be off on my actual dates, this timeline is absolute, folks. And the timeline is really important. Basically, it started off bad, false, treasonous, I might add, and it ended up even worse. What's really interesting is, and I'm going to quote right here from the memo. It's paragraph 3, I believe, on page 3. Before and after Steele was terminated as a source, he maintained contact with DOJ via then Associate Deputy Attorney General Bruce Orr. A senior DOJ, he was actually fourth in command, a senior DOJ official who worked closely with Deputy Attorney Generals Yates, and there's Sally again, and Rosenstein. Oh, what a friendly little family we have. You know, I'm sure they all got together every night and roasted marshmallows out there by the campfire in front of the Department of Justice. Let me continue. During the same time that we had always assume this, we had heard news reports, now we know it for fact. During the same time period, Orr's wife was employed by Fusion GPS. This is the outfit that had hired and paid Steele $160,000 to assist in the cultivation of opposition research on Trump. Orr later provided the FBI with all of his wife's opposition research, paid for by the DNC and the Clinton campaign via Fusion GPS. The Orr's relationship, this is a key sentence, folks, the Orr's relationship with Steele and Fusion GPS was inexplicably concealed from the FISC, that is the FISA court. Pretty amazing. So you see, you had political motives here, you had ideological motives here, you had deep state motives here, and you also, on the part of some players that we know of so far, had economic considerations. Steele was getting paid a lot of money to do this. Bruce Orr, the fourth in command of DOJ, has a wife that's getting paid money to put together the dossier that Steele is shopping around and getting paid money to shop around. I mean, wow. So those are my big takeaways from the memo, which I don't think a lot of other news media, maybe no other news medias are covering. They do have a pretty good list of other salient points. I'm not going to repeat them here. You can read them right here on the website under the appropriate articles under treason. But here's what's more important. While the memo has revealed certain facts, and the memo has shown us that things were really worse than we supposed, in a way, the memo, at least for me, and for I would assume most of you if you've been listening to me for more than a year, is really not a big surprise. It's surprising in how bad it really was, but it's not a surprise in terms of the structural mechanics of the badness, if you follow what I'm saying. But this memo, as you can tell by the hue and cry of the Democrats, the mainstream media, the Department of Justice, John Kerry, Eric Holder, I mean, the entire list, they think it's a really big deal. And I think they are rightfully scared of the fact that they know, and I think Devin Nunes, who's been a real patriot in all this, and Trey Gowdy and others plan to be releasing more and more stuff. I think Devin Nunes, just yesterday, Friday, talked about the fact that this was just phase one, which kind of corroborated what I was instinctively feeling about what was going on here. And I think before this whole thing is said and done, folks, I think Jeff Sessions is going to have to step up to the plate or step down, and somebody else will step up to the plate. I think a number of these people are, in fact, we are actually going to see prosecutions and indictments. I think you're going to see the release of reams and reams and reams of information. I think there's going to be so much sunlight on this stuff. It's going to sparkle like a new snow on a high mountain type on a blue sky day. I think it's going to take time. But I really do think that this is the beginning of the end of the shadow government, of Obama's shadow government. And it's going to expand to other places, including the State Department. Mark my words. This is going to be a bigger and bigger, faster and faster, heavier and heavier snowball. And this memo was the opening of the first floodgate in the draining of the swamp, which is why the swamp screamed and yelled and threatened as much as they did. My other takeaways from this is that what's going to start coming out, let me step back. Do you remember how this all started? How many of you can raise your hand? Well, listen, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, whenever it was, and I don't mean to downplay it, we had the incredible spectacle of the United States not coming to the aid of brave Americans fighting to save other brave Americans in a far-off land for American interests. And I'm talking about Benghazi. And I told you at the time, because everybody was poo-pooing it and blah, 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 and it's going to go away. I told you at the time, folks, I said, this is a really, really, really big deal. And it's never really going to go away. We have not heard the end of it. It will eventually be a major ingredient in the downfall of Hillary Clinton and those that are around her. And, you know, I got emails and I got letters. This is years ago. Oh, what are you talking about? They're going to get off with it and blah, 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 so forth. If you trace this back, it is the investigation of Benghazi that revealed Clinton's 33,000 missing emails because the subpoena came out of the Benghazi investigation. It revealed her illegal server. It put Obama in a vice because he had been corresponding through an alias with the illegal server and lying about it. It put the deep state folks heading up the FBI and the DOJ in a tizzy because all the stuff they had known, all the law breaking they were fully cognizant of at state, at DOJ, at FBI, you name it, was suddenly like in the light through the Benghazi investigation. So it is the Benghazi investigation which began this whole current scenario. If the investigation had not been launched into Clinton's acts and lack of acts in Benghazi, none of this might have been coming to light. In fact, she might have been elected president, in which case none of this would have ever seen the light. That's what they were counting on. You know, Comey tweeted yesterday, I can't believe it. I mean, wow. You talk about arrogance. You talk about thinking you're above it all. You can't be touched. Wow. Listen, Mr. Comey, you are not Elliot Ness. You are not an untouchable. And I think you're going to find that out. He tweeted, that's all? Question mark. I mean, wow. What cojones. Whew. And then he talked about how, you know, this destroyed the trust between the intelligence agencies and the select committee. And it just made you want to puke. The other really big impact this is going to have, besides the fact we're going to see more and more and more in many more directions, including other, mark my words, other illegally obtained FISA warrants. This is going to lead us right back to what nobody has been talking about other than me for the past 4 months, which is the illegal unmasking by Susan Rice, Ben Rhodes, and Samantha Powers. I mean, I don't know how Obama got her to do it, over at the United Nations, the ambassador to the United Nations for the United States under Obama. The illegal unmasking of 300, that's right, 300, American citizens. More unmaskings in the last several months of the Obama administration than in the previous 8 years combined. All of them in one way, shape, or form connected to Donald Trump, his campaign, or his transition. Now, one of the things which... Let me explain to you why I know 99.9999999% that there's other FISA felonies sitting out there, improperly obtained by frauds in the court, FISA warrants. Because if you've unmasked illegally 300 Americans, those 300 Americans weren't unmasked just through one continuing FISA warrant on poor Carter Page, who was a two-bit player on the fringes of the Trump campaign, folks. There had to be a whole bunch more FISA warrants for that many people to be unmasked. And the unmasking itself is multiple counts of felony. I think you're going to see the expansion and renewed energy in the Uranium One investigation, which we already know that Sessions is on because the first real indictment in that deal in 4 years, since Mueller and Comey swept it under the table, just came down 2 weeks ago. I talked to you about it on the show. I think you're going to see Hillary Clinton's foundation truly investigated. There has been no real investigation of the foundation. I think you're going to be, and it's tied into what's going on here at state, DOJ, etc. I told you last week, I believe it was, that I want to see the bank accounts of all these people. I want to know how Strzok can afford $1,000 an attorney. I want to know what happened to the $700,000 that McCabe and his wife got from Hillary for supposedly for her campaign for a state legislature house, $700,000. I want to follow the money. I want to see the bank accounts of all these people. All the bank accounts and all the deposits. And you know, I have this funny feeling that you're going to see a lot of Hillary Clinton dirty money floating in a lot of different pockets. Because that's who she is, that's who they are, and that's what this is. I think you're going to see an investigation finally of Barry Obama's crimes. Now, I don't know if he's ever going to be indicted. I mean, I think the chances are probably against it for a whole bunch of reasons, none of which I agree with. But I think his name's going to get dragged through the mud, and he's going to be exposed for the corrupt alt-left Islamist he is. And one of the deals that's going to be exposed is him letting Hezbollah off the hook to get the Iran deal done. And by off the hook, meaning allowing them to continue to smuggle people, guns, and cocaine into the United States for hundreds of millions of dollars because they didn't want to piss off Iran, for whom Hezbollah is their surrogate. I think you're going to see more come up on the IRS. Do I think they're ever going to get Lerner? I don't think her immunity agreements can be breached, but I think you're going to see more about it. I think you're going to see a reopening of the investigation, mark my words, on Hillary's destruction of evidence, destruction and mishandling of classified material, her server, and her 33,000 emails. And I would wager you that a good number of those emails are going to surface at some time. I don't care how much bleach bit she used. I don't care what she's erased. They are out there somewhere. China may have them. Russia may have them. North Korea may have them. Who knows who has them, but they're out there somewhere. And when it behooves the actor that has them to release them, they will do so. And those emails are going to further generate a head of steam under the investigations on Uranium One, the foundation, the pay-for-play, the whole nine yards. Mark my words, this is going to happen. I think you're going to see, I think there's a very good chance you're going to see some type of action taken against Cheryl Mills and Uba Abedin for lying to the FBI. I think I think Lynch is in trouble. She's going to be sweating bullets as these investigations get closer and closer to her. I think Eric Holder, and you can tell his tweets are kind of panicked over the last week about why the memo shouldn't be released and blah, 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 blah. You know, this is the guy who was held in contempt of Congress. This is the guy who allowed Fast and Furious to happen and killed one of our border agents. I mean, I wouldn't even bore you with all the things he did. This is the guy who maintained he was the wingman of Barack Obama. And I think you're going to see some stuff come out on that too. And I absolutely positively think you're going to see Rice and Rhodes, probably the two biggest liars on the progressive left, and that's really saying something. I think you're going to see Rice and Rhodes under a microscope. And I think they're going to wilt. In conclusion, there was absolutely treason, collusion, anti-American, foreign-influenced bad stuff happening in the 2016 election and throughout the first year of Donald Trump's presidency. But it was not, folks, by Donald Trump. What really happened here is that Hillary Clinton using money she had illegally obtained from foreign governments through her foundation, financed a campaign, which, with her full knowledge and the knowledge of others like the Podestras, hired Fusion GPS, paid them over $12 million and tried to launder it through their law firm. The law firm paid Fusion GPS. Fusion GPS paid a foreign agent, a former British spy, Christopher Steele, to go to the Russians to get Russian propaganda to influence an American election, an American history, an American presidency, and American history. That's what happened here. And this memo is somebody turning the valve on the first drainpipe, the first floodgate on the swamp. It's going to be a really, really, really interesting year. There's one other thing that I want to throw out as a caution. All of this, and I don't think it was intended to, I think it on its own, even if there wasn't a special prosecutor, this is the rule of law, the Constitution, this stuff had to come out, it has to be cleaned up. But I think that Bob Mueller is going to get worried that his investigation is going to get shut down based on all this stuff. And that could lead him to try and make a shot at Trump sometime in the next 6 months to kind of justify his existence and under the adage that a good offense is the best defense. So don't be too surprised if you start hearing stirrings about that. How it's going to wind up, I don't know. But something to keep in mind. So next week we're going to talk about some really, really, really important economic stuff that's going to affect you and your family that you need to be aware of. Another canary in the economic coal mine, maybe a couple. And I hope I've given you some stuff to think about this morning. And you know, all I can say is go USA. Thanks Devin Nunes and Trey Gowdy. And let's clean up this mess. Folks, this is the United States of America. This simply cannot be allowed to continue. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.